to another Global Crossroads conversation with Chris Smith and the author Mo Tejani.
Global Crossroads, the book. Hopefully you've just read the chapter on Mother India. And my name's Chris Smith, Shambles Guru on the interweb. And I'm with the guy who wrote those words that you just read, hopefully, Mo Tejani.
Namaste.
Oh, and he did a nice sign there. Pity it's not a video.
They can imagine the hands coming together.
And you're hopefully already familiar with what we're doing. We're doing these audio sections after each chapter, after each section. And Mother India, as a reminder, is the third story in the Culture Warp section, which is the second section. But Mo, right. Mother India is almost a book in itself, isn't it? It's big. It's a big section.
It's a mini novel, yes. Yes. And it didn't start off that way, but as I got into this monologue with myself and with Gandhi and with India, it just took off on its own, and I had to keep going with it until it was finished.
Yeah, you said to me before we started, and before all of these, we have a little chat to try and decide what we're going to do. Mm-hmm, but they tend to be very impromptu and spontaneous, hopefully.
Which is the best part of it.
He worried me a bit because he said, you know, this is a monologue about my discussions with Gandhi. But I thought he was, how old are you, Mo?
I refuse to answer on the grounds that it might incriminate me. Okay. No, but I turned 60 a few months ago.
But you didn't really talk with Gandhi, did you?
It's an imaginary Gandhi. But yes. He's my, for lack of a better term, my confessional priest on this 4-week journey in a loop of traveling through southern India to the states of Tamil Nadu, Karnataka, and
sorry, and say Chennai. That say that again very slowly for me.
It's an imaginary Gandhi that only I can see.
No, the place.
Oh, the places. Yes. Well, the three states that I explore.
Right.
In southern India, Kerala, Karnataka, and Tamil Nadu.
No, that's the bit I needed again. You must remember I'm a very... Right. I'm Tamil Nadu. I'm not as global as you are.
Tamil Nadu, Karnataka, and Kerala are the three most southern states of India.
Oh, okay. Mm.
And I did a loop for 4 to 5 weeks on the rails, on traveling by train, which is how Indians travel, the majority of them. Just to see for myself how they cope, how they survive on a day-to-day basis. And this is where the imaginary Gandhi comes in, because I'm reflecting on Gandhi's ideals, my ideals about India, and yet the reality of the overwhelming diversity of India that brings up a myriad of situations every single day, sometimes every single hour.
Is that something that happened in retrospect or happened during the journey itself?
Absolutely, during the journey.
During the journey itself?
India is like a Fellini movie. It's a kaleidoscope of emotions and visual input and all other kinds of input that you are constantly bombarded with day in and day out. Some of them that bring nothing but joy, and some of them that bring nothing but tears. That whole spectrum is India, which is why it's so hard to define India. But my purpose, really, Chris, as I talk about in the beginning part of the story, is I have to backtrack a little bit. Where I grew up in Uganda, the home address of where I lived in Kampala, in the capital city, was 8 Madras Gardens. And it was right next to another residential complex called Bombay Gardens and another one called Delhi Gardens. In other words, these Indian families in these three residential complexes had created a little India.
Yes.
With Sikhs, Hindus, Muslims, Bohras, all different kinds of ethnic groups from India that had migrated to Uganda living there. And we ate Indian food, we played Indian games, we talked in Hindi and Gujarati. Of course, we had interaction with the African population too. But it was a little India, which was the parental way of saving the heritage in a foreign place like Africa. So an essential part of me growing up in Africa is also very much this little India complex conclave that we lived in and all that it brought up during my childhood.
But your family were born in India?
My father was born in India. My mother, also of Indian origin, was born in a small island called Lamu off the coast of Kenya. And they met each other and went through an arranged marriage, being of the same sect and religion, and arranged marriages being the norm at that time.
They would have been arranged by your grandparents?
By my mother's grandparents, yes, and my and yeah. Well, in this case, not my father's parents, because my father came alone from India at the age of 24, 25, back in the 1920s.
Why did he move?
He moved because life in India was difficult, because life in India meant continuous poverty. So when the British, in their wisdom, decided to build the East African Railway from the coast of Kenya all the way down to Uganda, not only did they need very skilled laborers and foremen and people who spoke English to supervise the cheap African labor, but they also needed teachers for the schools in these three East African countries. My father at that time had just finished a somewhat of a post A-levels technical degree.
This must have been about the 1930s.
That's right.
We're going back quite a way.
That's
now,
right.
Yeah?
That's right. He, like I say, well, you know, he realized that in order to get out of poverty, he's going to have to go somewhere else and make some money and bring the family over little by little, which is what he did. After being in East Africa, not Uganda, because he traveled and taught in different schools in Kenya and in Uganda and even in Tanzania. Eventually bringing all his four brothers to East Africa and his mother. His father had passed away when a road accident when he was quite young. So the history of the Ugandan, Kenyan and Tanzanian Asians is quite diverse in that some came as laborers, some came as foremen, some came as teachers, some came as the middlemen, economic middlemen that the British could have to be the buffer between the African populace and the British colonial power and its capital.
Sounds like it would be great to have had your dad here and talk with him now. Did you get your wanderlust from him?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I give him credit in the first book, first travel volume of my memoirs called A Chameleon's Tale. And I give him credit by saying, thank you, Bapuji, for giving me the courage to not fear the unknown. Because that's what he did.
Nice.
That's exactly what he did.
Brilliant gift to give to your
exactly.
Children, yes?
Yeah. I don't think I realized it until I was 14, 15, when I ran away from home to travel around East Africa, but that's where the wanderlust comes from.
What was the name you called him? Bapuji?
Bapuji. It's a term of, Bapa means father.
Yes.
Bapuji is a term of endearment, and it's a term that I use quite extensively in the story because it's also the same term that is used for the revered one, meaning Mahatma Gandhi.
Really?
Everybody in India calls Bapuji, Gandhi, Bapuji or Gandhiji.
Yes.
Ji is just a term of endearment,
yes,
of affection, of reverence that we use in both Hindi and Gujarati, which Gujarati being my mother tongue.
Interesting. Now, our challenge in these little conversations that we're having is, of course, as we said before, not to give the story away, because we're assuming people have read the chapter, so
right,
it's pointless revisiting that.
We'll skirt around the issues as best as we can.
Okay, we'll try and do that. and learning from the last time we talked, Mo, what should I ask you now?
What is India to me? That's a good place to start, because that gets us into all different kinds of areas of concepts without really talking about the actual events that happen in the story. You see, as I was telling you, Chris, having grown up in a little India in Uganda, when I first go to India, I realize, and by the way, that first time that I go to India is an episode that's in the first book as well, in Chameleon's Tale, where I'm looking for a lost aunt, and maybe we'll talk about that a little later. But when I go to India, I realize that there are so many emotions that are invoked in me when I'm in India. The games I played, the food I ate, the languages I speak, the faces, the nonverbal gestures, etc. That in so many ways it felt like home. And yet, it didn't feel like home in so many other ways.
This was the first time you'd been.
Absolutely. And that process, even though I've been there multiple times, never stops.
You still experience that?
Never stops.
Yes.
Because I will always find new things that remind me of what life was like in my childhood. But I will always find other things happening in modern urban India that confront my own beliefs. And back to that topic that we talked about in previous podcasts of culture baggage and culture clash. So it's an ongoing tug of war between me, what's in my mind, and India. And that's really what I'm trying to explore in depth in the story by just recounting all the various amazing, mind-boggling things that happened to me.
Does it give anything away, do you think, if I ask you about, to illustrate, give me some illustrative content of what you just said. For example, you said body language. You said body, you know, what is it special?
It's too bad we don't have a video here, because every culture and every language has its nonverbal communicative gestures. And yet, I am very aware, only when I'm in India, that a lot of my gestures are very, very Indian. But I don't see them all around me, because most of the time I'm not in India. But when I'm in India, I see them reflected. It's like having a mirror, you know? without getting into too much detail, the way we snap our fingers, the way we roll our eyes, the way we give a high five, which is actually a low five when you're sharing a joke, all those kind of nonverbal gestures kick in from the minute you land in India. And you have to remember, I've been a global nomad roaming in different parts of the world for the last four decades. So as soon as I land into India, all these different things, whether it's the nonverbals, whether it's the language, whether it's the kinds of food you're eating, all kick in all at the same time.
So it's sort of like riding a bike. It just, you never forget, right?
It just, you, not only that, but it feels like, you know, you've been riding the bike for a long time. You just forgot that you were on the bike.
Yes.
That sort of feeling, yes. You know, emotional roller coaster. Really,
yes.
Really.
So you felt at home straight away, and, you know.
And yet.
And you call it Mother India, this chapter.
And yet, when people read the story, they'll see I have some very strong non-Indian, as in a diasporic Indian living out of India, points of view on many things that happen in the story. Here's a good example without giving away much of the story. You know what my immediate categorical nickname was the minute I land in India? Oh, you are an NRI, aren't you? And I said, what is an NRI? NRI is a non-resident Indian. So you are Indian, but actually you are a non-resident. Immediately, that categorical box kicks in.
Listeners, it is a pity this isn't visual, because because he went into a role then, which I've not seen before, and his head started to move backwards and forwards. The Indian body language took over.
Kicks right in.
Just then, just by saying that, right?
So many people have done research that when you look into the language and the culture, all the nonverbals kick in.
Yes.
And it happens every time I start speaking about India, the accent kicks in.
Yes.
The speed with which you speak English kicks in. And, you know...
Sorry, what did they call you again? Tell me again. That was
NRI, non-resident Indian.
Okay.
The visa that I would have is also an NRI visa, because I'm a non-resident Indian. What that actually gives you in terms of privileges and stuff is debatable. But the point is made very clearly right from the beginning that just because you're an Indian and you have a lot of the cultural history that Indians have in places like Africa, in places like Trinidad, wherever Indians have moved to, doesn't mean that you think like an Indian. You see, it's a double-edged sword in that, as I said before, one feels very much at home in the sense of seeking some kind of identity and belonging to a community, and yet one is constantly confronted with situations that challenge your beliefs. I'll give you a very small example because it comes up quite a few times in the story. Queuing up to buy a ticket or queuing up to board a train is a humongous ordeal in most parts of India. Not because there is no system in place. There's a very good computerized system in place. But when things don't work out the way they're supposed to, chaos reigns immediately. Total panic. Everybody rushes into...
What do you mean there's only 3 seats left on the train?
No, there could be 300. But keep in mind that India now has 1 billion people.
Yes.
So there will never be 300 people going on a train. There will be more like 3,000 or maybe even 10,000. So you're competing for a seat. And most train rides, unless it's a short local train ride, are 10 to 20 hours long. Huh?
Mm.
So fighting for a seat is important because it means you won't be standing for a long time.
I'm hesitant to ask you this, but didn't the British in 1947 was independence, wasn't it?
Correct.
Didn't the British leave sort of one of their legacies, wasn't that a well-organized civil service?
It's interesting that you say that.
Oh, I've touched on something. Aha,
it's interesting. Let me roll my eyes, even if the listener can't see
it. He's doing it again.
The civil service, by many, is seen as the fulcrum point of some kind of organizational structure in the Indian society, and by others as the biggest bane, nightmare, bureaucratic disaster for the Indian society. Let me explain further, because this is not part of the story. At one point in my life, I had decided, out of some fantasy left over from childhood, that the lady that I thought I was going to marry, I should marry her in the Himalayan mountains.
Well, that because sounds it nice sounded and romantic.
Romantic,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, it sounds lovely.
But she happened to be a Catholic.
So?
And I'm a Muslim. So I go into Delhi with the idea of wanting to get a piece of paper that would legitimize the marriage. And I was told by the Indian civil service fellow.
We touched a nerve here.
Mr. Tejani, this is impossible to do. For multiple reasons. The first one, you have to put a piece of paper saying you want to marry this woman who's a Catholic on the bulletin board of a public institution and leave it there for a month in case somebody wants to object. Number two, once nobody has objected, we need verification that you have parental consent from the wife-to-be and the husband-to-be, and that there is absolutely no funny business in your previous life before you get married. This goes on
No funny business between you and your fiancé.
Meaning you haven't been married before, don't have alimony to pay, or meaning you're not a grave digger, meaning you're not an axe murderer, what have you.
Okay.
And this goes on and on. I'm not going to belabor it, but it shows you the wonderful, crazy, maddening, driving you nuts bureaucracy that India is today. And Indians go through this every single day. It was just a whim that I thought it would be nice to get married in the Himalayas. But once I saw the nightmare that was facing me, I said, guess what? We've got mountains in Thailand. We can do that there, you know.
Oh, that was a bit sad.
Well, it was sad. But, you know, anybody that lives in India will tell you that the bureaucracy, proficient as it was in certain aspects of control and power vis-a-vis the colonial civil service, has turned into a monstrous, humongous, Kafka-like nightmare.
Really?
Yes.
I understand civil servants are for life.
Exactly my point.
Aren't they? They start at the age of whatever it is.
Right, and it provides financial security, it provides job security, and it provides an opportunity for you to do nothing but comb your hair while somebody's waiting for you to serve them for the next half an hour.
If we go on your love-hate spectrum, civil servants come closer to the hate end than the love end, don't they?
And you know what's interesting about that? It's not just my spectrum. I think most Indians would agree with me about the civil service.
Really?
Yes.
That's strange, because I thought that I'm never going to mention this to anybody in the world. I thought the British left them a really nice, you know, they left them rule of law and the civil servants and
well,
that, but and the, rail, and the railways.
Give credit where it's due.
And the railways.
Give credit and the railways. The railways, I fully agree with. They provided a very good infrastructural development of the country so that there's access to all different parts of the subcontinent, given that it's a pretty large country to start off with. But the other point that you were touching on that skipped my mind now. the educational system.
Oh, that's right. The British education system has a lot to answer for, but we better not
start
with that.
But the British educational system, as it was implemented eventually, a little bit pre-independence, but a lot more post-independence in 1947, the heritage of that is a very, very good system.
Yes.
You know, so, as you well know, almost 30% of Microsoft staff comes from India.
Mm. Without sourcing.
As you well know, some of the best literature, modern day literature, including many, many Booker Prize winners, come from India.
Tell me a bit more. You say I knew that. I don't know that. Tell me a bit more about Indian literature.
Rabindranath Tagore, in my opinion, was one of the pioneers of Indian literature maybe two centuries ago. Since then, a whole spat of writers have come around that have won Nobel Prizes for literature, that have won Booker Prizes, that have won Pulitzer Prizes. It's almost as if getting Indian authors international prizes is in vogue. It's in fashion. I can give you numerous examples. Agiga with White Tiger, Arundhati Roy with God of Small Things, Salman Rushdie with Midnight Children. The list goes on. V.S. Naipaul, Nobel laureate of Indian origin, diasporic Indian from Trinidad, nevertheless of Indian origin. There are so many very wonderful, wonderful writers, so much so that diasporic Indian literature is almost a genre in itself now.
Why do you think that is?
There's a lot to say. India is an amazing conglomerate of diversity, billion people, democracy, with individual states that are communist in ideology and in practice, hundreds of different ethnic groups, culture clash at its best in the sense of ethnic, not just clash, but hatred and violence. And yet India, this amazing place for the Westerners, and I talk a lot about this in the story, is the spiritual mother of the world. This is a place that most Westerners, even before Beatles made it famous with Rishikesh and Ravi Shankar and doing meditation and yoga in the Himalayas, even before that, Westerners in their search for looking to find other ways to live life and going to the East, especially India, have always gravitated to finding ashrams and temples and yoga centers and things like that to try and find a different paradigm to the lifestyle they have in the West. It's beautiful the way it works, you know. People in India, if you ask them, where would you prefer to be if you had the means and resources to go, they go, of course, America or somewhere in Europe. I can make a lot of money. I can find security for my family. I can live an easy life, and their illusion is still that the streets are paved with gold. And yet you ask the Westerner that's living a different life of mortgages and banks and having to pay the car loan and realizing that the government is not helping when you have a flood in the country or what have you, like Katrina. They all want to go east. Find some spiritual center. Find some focus on my life. Find somebody that'll teach me how to be a better human being and a more compassionate one. That east-west scenario.
So the Indian Slumdog Millionaire, was that the name of the film?
That's right.
Was it a book before a film? Or?
Absolutely. It's a book by a man called Vikas Swarup called Q&A, Question and Answer. But because of the success of the film in that it won, I think, 8 awards, Oscar awards, it has become a sensation. But, you know, the simple beauty of the movie is the fact that it's based on a game show that originates in the West and gets applied to in an Indian context, in an Indian style, in the East, meaning India. And you would be amazed at the amount of varied reactions that film has generated since. For example, good, this is not in the book, so this is good stuff, relevant stuff. Slumdog Millionaire portrays India as a third world country. How ridiculous, says one. Says another, Slumdog Millionaire is India's greatest achievement since Gandhi, and since the movie Gandhi, which was also an amazing film, if you recall. Vikas Swarup I met in Bali at a writer's festival 2 years ago, the author. And one of the questions that was asked him, which was a little controversial, saying, so you wrote this book about slums of Mumbai, and you made a ton of money from it. Has any of it gone back to the slum that you made the movie of?
Great question.
Given the fact that you had never visited a slum before you wrote the book?
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Boom!
Really?
Vikas Swarup works for the diplomatic mission. Vikas Swarup is not the kind of fellow who would be going to slums often. So it was a very valid question. The man immediately became very defensive and said, none of your bloody business.
Really?
I know what to do with my money, and I'm fully aware of what charitable deeds I do. You see, that complicates the issue in terms of A, the movie, B, the success of the movie, and C, the consequences. Chris, one of the greatest visuals I have in my head, since I like to watch the silver screen quite a bit, is watching these four kids from that very slum where the movie was made at the Oscars in Los Angeles.
I didn't see that.
Walking down the red carpet, holding golden Oscar awards in their hands. It was an amazing sight of joy. And yet, the government promised them housing. The government promised them all kinds of rewards, most of which have not materialized. And I believe 2 or 3 of the kids still live in the slums. So what did they get out of it? They're the most brilliant actors in the movie. They're natural, they're spontaneous, they're kid-like, they're just playing their roles. Did they get anything out of it? Or is it only Danny Boyle and the protagonists that are in the movie that got something out of it, Danny Boyle being the director of the movie. So it brings up interesting questions of the kind of things we experience in India, you know?
That movie is a great illustration. I think it seems to be a great illustration of your theme for this part of the book, doesn't it? Culture warp. Because yeah, that sounds very warped, the exactly. contrast there.
Exactly. And what's even more amazing is the warpedness, if I can concoct a word, that goes on in my own brain during the trips. I say trips because it's never stopped every time I've been to India. You know, it becomes an identity crisis of sorts every time I go to India.
In what way?
It becomes an identity crisis of sorts because, as you well pointed out, as soon as I was talking about India, the Indian accent kicked in. the gesticulation kicked in.
The head.
The head. The all-purpose nod, as we say in, as I talk about in the story as well. Identity crisis in the sense of, it's really like a little bit like, if you recall the movie and the book, Roots. You feel like you're going back to your roots. Then all of a sudden something happens, like a totally chaotic religious festival that, for the outsider, not living those kind of rituals on a day-to-day basis, is not only chaotic, it's mad hysteria. It's people going nuts trying to give food to an elephant called Ganesh, who is a god. And you start thinking, what is the purpose here? What do the children think? Are they being brainwashed into participating because they're still the children and not the parents? You know, all these questions come into play. I will take one small anecdote from the book, which is what we said we wouldn't do, but there's a part in the movie, in the book where a vendor and his daughter are alone with me and two other Canadian guys at a lake. We're swimming there. They came around just so they could sell a few things to us, mix it with me. And on the other side of the lake, there's a woman that pops out of the lake in a bikini.
It wasn't Bo Derek, was it?
It looked just like Bo Derek's scenario.
Really?
You know, it was the way she walked out. And you have to remember that bikinis are not something you would see in 99% of India. Mm. So this woman walks out in a bikini, which shocks the father. He immediately shields the daughter's eyes.
How old was the daughter?
9, 10. Yes. And she pushes his hand away because she is fascinated with the white skin and the showing of the flesh. And on top of that, to add insult to injury, as she walks out of the water and she gets to the shoreline, there's a brown man without a shirt, an Indian fella, who's his boyfriend, who's her boyfriend,
yes,
who comes to kiss her in public.
Public display of affection.
Exactly. This is when the father says, forget this shielding her daughter's, his daughter's eyes. She grabs her by the hand and said, time to leave. And what gets into my head is, what is the child thinking? Is the child thinking, my dad's right? Is the child thinking, my dad's an old-fashioned fella? Is the child thinking, Ashirai Rai, Miss World for and very well-known superstar, is okay, but me seeing a white woman in a bikini is not? The double standard? I don't know. India poses hundreds of questions and very few answers, in my opinion.
That's a
for me.
That's a real clash. If you were the dad, what would you have done?
What I can only say what I would have done based not so much on whether if values. I was the dad,
yes.
Dad, or but what I believe one should expose children to in terms of parenting. I believe that the more you expose a child to things that shock them or
challenge them,
the more the opportunity to educate them of all the things that revolve around that particular issue. You know, I have a son, and when my son was with me in the Philippines and he saw his first transvestite, he was fascinated by it, and he said, what's going on? And I said, yeah, that's...
So you shielded his eyes and said, come
over. I took him over. I said, let's go have a conversation with this girl to see if it's a boy or a girl.
Yes.
And after the conversation was over, we processed it in as much as you can process something like that with a 13-year-old. It's a learning tool. I'm a teacher. I've been a teacher for a while. So I just use that as an opportunity. Now, whether that father in that situation sees it that way or not, or whether his cultural beliefs and his traditions prevent him from doing anything like that, who knows?
You probably felt very uncomfortable, and the coping strategy is you remove yourself from the area of discomfort.
Escape.
Yes, you escape. So that's not surprising, but But this touches.
But you see the dichotomy then, yeah. Right? My dichotomy says expose, and the reality says escape.
Yes.
And yet, in many other situations, it's integrate so easily.
Mm.
So.
But these East versus West conflicts come up throughout the book so much, don't they?
They certainly come out in this whole section of culture warp, yes. Much more so. And they come out in different ways, in different cultural contexts, in the other two sections. But
you didn't take a picture of Bo Derek for the book, did you? I'm really disappointed with that.
Well, I did, but unfortunately, I'm not a professional photographer, so it was a little blurred, the picture. and my tech guy, Mr. Chris Smith, told me, not usable.
Sorry, listeners, he's not in the book. But check with Google.
We can maybe Photoshop it.
No, we've been going for 35 minutes, and so we should be thinking about closing it, bring it to an end. What?
I think I'll just tie it in, if I can, with a couple of quotes that are from the story, and that will probably, hopefully, induce the reader that hasn't read the story to read it. There's a place where, in a particular instance, I say to myself, surely this sea of humanity will impart some of its coping strategies for daily survival to me. There's another part where I say, again, over another incident, unfortunately, the cultural baggage of my history follows me everywhere I go, even in foreign lands. Much like the silhouette of an omnipresent shadow. These are all tidbits that'll hopefully will titillate.
You always listener. Talk about, so far, I think you've always talked about cultural baggage in a negative way. Or am I? What? It doesn't have to be, does it? Negative?
Well, you give me an example where it's in a positive way, and we can have a little bit of discussion about that too.
Maybe later.
Exactly. It's not so easy to find.
Okay. Go back to your quotes.
Exactly. You know, I say, welcome to new Microsoft India when describing Bangalore, which is the Silicon Valley.
It is, isn't it?
Silicon Valley of India.
There's a lot of talent there.
And I'm saying to Gandhi, my imaginary Gandhi, welcome to new Microsoft India, my dear sage. Gadgets and instant messaging are the norm these days. No more sitar and tabla music parties on Saturday nights. Takes too long. You see the contrast?
Yes.
And that's not to say that the contrast is wrong. That's not to say that whatever traditional beliefs still exist in India are wrong. There's no right and wrong. There's just constant mutations and changes and transformations. And India is going through that every single day. With a billion people from hundreds of different ethnic groups trying to live together and still thinking that it's a living, breathing democracy, where freedom of expression is supposed to be the avant-garde of. By the way, the media in India is very good. And is very open compared to some countries in parts of Asia. You know, it's that conflicting scenario that you would find in any country, really, except that it's multiplied so tenfold, if you like, in India, of finding so many anomalies and at the same time finding so many things that, at least for me as a diasporic Indian, harmonize with you. And that dichotomy of the two, trying to find ways to bridge that gap. The battle continues.
The battle continues is probably a good phrase to finish with.
Exactly.
because our journey through the book continues.
This recording is one of the Global Crossroads Conversations with Chris Smith and the author Mo Tejani.